Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Shannon Veif, who's a transhumanist, cryonicist, an extreme life extensionist, mother, Unitarian Universalist, social activist, religious educator, and author of 21st Century Kids and the Scientific Conquest of Death. Thank you, Shannon, so much for being with me today.
Thank you. It's a VIF.
I thought that as I was saying it, and I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, I get that all the time. I've got that. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about your book, your children's book, first of all, because that's really interesting. 21st Century Kids. So I read a description of it, which was hyperdrives, nano-minting, accelerated brains with direct computer interfaces, conversations with dolphins, indefinite lifespan. So this sounds like a different sort of children's book. Can you tell me like what it's about and kind of how you came up with it?
Oh, yeah. It first started, I guess, with writing it for my own children. Mm-hmm. When they were young, my daughter, who is 20 now, when she was about 7 years old, I started kind of telling her a story, and it was a way of explaining things that kind of could happen if cryonics worked, but it's sort of was looking at things that scientists see as possible. So it's not dystopic, it's not utopic, and the society kind of has problems, even has religions. The AI have their own religion. Hmm. They're much more into still exploring and doing the space, you know, travel, maybe a little bit more than the humans. So I guess that's, it was really to open up in an adventure, like fiction format, just different areas of conversations. And I've heard from other parents who have contacted me that they liked that aspect, you know, being able to talk about some of the futurists or transhumanist ideas with their kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's incredible. I mean, it's really important, I think, to, you know, to have these kinds of conversations. I'm reminded of like old anti-drug commercials I saw going up, which is like, you know, have the conversation with your kids, you know, that kind of stuff. And I love that you're bringing this into this kind of childhood setting, and it seems so much more positive than some kinds of attempts at this I've seen.
Yes. Yeah, they're different. I've looked at some different books. It's hard to engage children. I mean, engage their sense of imagination and get them thinking creatively. Like, you have to get them interested. But the other flip side to that is having an adult also talk about the issues. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I have a new young child, the one that is 3.5 years old, and she's not old enough where I've read this to her, but I've been thinking about 4.5 or so, maybe starting. But the adults have a responsibility just to kind of teach, I think, what kind of possibilities there are in science in the future, along with teaching history and along with teaching science and math and reading and just all of the things that we try to, you know, lay a groundwork for.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that kind of optimism that you're expressing, you know, that, okay, these kids are going to experience 200 years in the future and there are going to be these powerful, positive changes. Is that optimism healthy? Is it useful? You know, compare that?
Yeah, I definitely think it's healthy for kids to be optimistic and not to, because they learn when you're learning about history and you learn about what's going on in the news. At least I experienced this with my own kids when they become, you know, middle school age and teenagers. They become very disillusioned or upset with the way some things are, and they become, well, I've always believed in being realistic about things, even when they're younger. Mm-hmm. I guess my feeling on it is a fun story that is optimistic, although, like I said, it's not a utopian and not everything's optimistic in it. You can talk about the real things and the things that haven't happened, the things that could happen, and introduce ethics and ways things that could go wrong, and what their feelings are on it. So I guess at different ages, kids have different feelings about that. Should you be able to, you know, select what genes you want with your own children, or, you know, just mm-hmm. whatever the issue is. I think it opens up conversations about ethics.
Yeah. Well, and you've involved your kids in these kind of futurist projects in a lot of ways. I think I was reading about your daughter going door to door raising money for the Methuselah Prize.
Yes. Yes. That was when she was, I guess, about 8 or so. We had been reading Highlights magazine, and there was a story about a boy who raised $3,000 for diabetes. And I had read I forgot the name of the story, but the dragon, the one that's written for kids. That, okay. Yeah. Do you know which one?
I
Google real quick.
Yeah.
Isn't it Nick Bostrom?
Yeah. Nick Bostrom's Dragon Tyrant. Yeah.
Yeah, Dragon. Okay. So I had read her that, and we had been talking about life extension because of the book and all of these. And she wanted to, I told her about that there was an organization trying to end aging, and she wanted to raise money for it. That was her idea, and she wanted this goal of $3,000 because that's what the boy in the story or you know, in Highlights that was covered had done. So I wasn't too sure how that would work or if I wanted to do that. I had two other kids that were younger, so it was kind of difficult. She wanted to do it when we went going out after school. So it became kind of a fun thing. I would go with her, and I think she was I had to assist by talking to people or, you know, knocking on the door. But she would talk, and she was kind of honing her own, skills with debating different aspects of life extension. And she was pretty successful. She came up with the idea to give pie with a donation. And I had said, the scientific conquest of death, with the level, and she wanted to give pie. So we went and we got these apple pies to give with a donation of whatever, you know, $25 or something. And also she set up a booth and she made, did the poster art for it at our UU church there. This was when we lived in Austin, Texas. So it became kind of a fun thing. And I had actually, drugged my feet and kind of put her off for a while. And she was the real impetus in getting it done. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, that's cool. Well, so yeah, let's talk about how this kind of fits into you know, your larger kind of world, because you wrote an essay in the Scientific Conquest of Death, which I think was called "Confessions of a Proselytizing Immortalist," and so that's really interesting. You know, you talked about in there that that a lot of times people started by asking about your lifestyle, and then would kind of end up asking about that you would end up having to kind of talk to them about cryonics and so forth.
Yes.
And that's a different conversation for most people, right? So what?
Oh yeah, that still happens. Yeah.
How does that, like, well, I guess first of all, like, explain that. What, how does the conversation go?
Definitely tongue in cheek. It's like, you know, I mean, it's just, I do mention it, but I don't try to talk people into it, but it's very, I think, well, since I have a new 3.5-year-old, I mean, I don't know. I think in life we always meet new people, but I've made a lot of new friends recently, because you do when kids are in the same age group, you know, the baby groups, the play groups, and then, you know, moving up, you know, we go to a lot of different, we were at a play group today. We go to a lot of different play groups. And so I meet a lot of different parents, and I still do calorie restriction. I have started that up again. I went on a break of, before I did, you know, the pregnancy and did IVF for my 4th pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So I had to, you know, increase my weight to increase the fertility. It was a very odd experience for me, because I'd been doing calorie restriction for so long. And then, so I was off, and then also, you know, through breastfeeding. So, you know, because you have to keep your calories up for making milk and all of that. And so, I think that, like, many of my friends that I've made, I think everybody at some point, it's kind of a fun thing to interject, or it leads to, and it's just a different kind of conversation, because they're like, oh, you know, like, everybody knows about chronics, and then, like, they've already known me through play groups, or we've done other things at each other's houses, or been to, you know, beaches or aquariums or meet up at zoos, or, you know, all the things we do, going to the science museum. And then, like, just to have, you know, oh, this person's a chronicist, and they tend to ask me questions about it. And a lot of people are surprised that it can be done in an inexpensive manner. That's one thing. And then, of course, as you pointed out before, people have different ideas. Like, is it a, you know, waste of money? Is it, you know, somebody getting rich off of it? And is it selfish? Or to a very extreme view, if you feel that you're giving back a lot, like if you recycle and you're really into environmentalism and you feel like, I don't know if you can live without, you know, driving a vehicle or using, like, mm-hmm. if you can only use clean energy, you know, things of this nature, like, would you be able to give back in the future? Like, what kind of things, or how could you, you know, help, and what would the earth be like? I think the most fun thing is when people have very different takes on what they think the future would be like. So I guess since I've been across this for 20 years, I think I've heard just about everything, from people being enslaved, the world being just taken over. I mean, just whatever it is, or, you know, people, there are so many different views. And my own, I always make sure to point out to people that my own views on it are that it's based on that it could work. There's science, like the brain is easier to preserve and have normal electrical looking activity. The rest of the body is not, like the heart. I mean, there are lots of things that are not able to be preserved very well with, you know, or brought back. Like if you, so there's a lot of, technology, and there are lots of advancements in society that would have to occur for it to work. So I always say I believe it has like a 1% chance or less of working. But for me, that's worth it. And I'm not personally somebody that would, like I would drive like a used car versus a brand new car, or not live in a really big house, or for me that, like just a chronics institute that is $28,000 that could be paid for out of life insurance. It's not, a very large amount. And if you feel you can do good or in the future, if it did work, it seems like it would make sense to try it, because it doesn't matter otherwise if it doesn't work, because whatever happens. So,
yeah. Well, how do you answer, you know, those kind of bullet questions? You kind of touched on it, but like, you know, is cryonics selfish? Is this, well, I don't know. There's all kinds of questions, but okay. So you've said, you know, it's not that expensive. You're able to, you know, make other kind of equivalent sacrifices. But what about, you know, the question of, well, are you just taking up space that somebody else should be using, that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the space one is interesting because burials do, too, take up space. And when you are doing cremation, it also causes pollution. And there are it doesn't take electricity to keep people in, you know, crop preserved, and it's not a environmentally unsound to make the liquid nitrogen. So the facilities that actually store, as they call, you know, patients until they know they can't be recovered in the future, they are giving back in taxes, and they're creating jobs, so they're also contributing to the community, maybe more than a cemetery. So there are, I guess there are different ways of like looking at that.
Yeah. So I actually heard, I don't know if it was you or someone else who suggested cryonics is a more green option. That's the more environmentally friendly option in that way.
It's probably me.
Yeah.
I did write that on the petition of, you know, people to have the right to choose cryonics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That really is interesting. Yeah. It's not something I've encountered before, certainly not something I've seen discussed.
Well, I've been an active cryonicist, and some people can't be open or active because they're worried, I guess, about how it will look for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like my own husband is fine with doing cryonics, but he's not someone who would go out and do interviews because he teaches at MIT, and he's just not, I'm the cryonicist. I'm the one that, you know, is much more interested in building community and trying to, like tell other people about it. Like it's not his, I guess it's more of my hobby. It's not his like hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess over the years, because I've been open, I've really had a lot of conversations. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of people and regular people and from all different backgrounds. So I've just heard so many different arguments. I mean, and that has also helped me with my own views, because if I encounter something I hadn't thought of before, just like, well, how does that work? I mean, there are, there are lots of different angles, I guess. And then the way that Chronics Institute and that community and Alcor, that the way that they're set up and the people that are in them, sometimes the people who communicate with each other online, it's a little bit of a echo chamber, I guess, is the current
Yep.
term. Because they're only talking with the other cryonicists.
Right.
And I guess if you are going out and you're talking with your kids, you know, their friends, parents, or, you know, people you meet at, you know, mom's groups, and it's just a mom's night out. Yeah, so you're just meeting a lot of regular people and talking about chronic. I guess you get a different view.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you know, you're talking about that kind of. Not many people are talking about it publicly, there was the case of Kim Suozzi. How do you pronounce that name? I can't.
Swayze. Yeah.
So a few years ago, she was a 23-year-old neuroscience student, and she was battling brain cancer, and she wanted to be cryopreserved, but couldn't afford it. And so she kind of put out this call for, I guess, help, call for, you know, asking for people to donate. And yeah, she accomplished that, right? That was something she was able to do, I think.
Yeah, someone in the comments, a chronicist in the comments, I think gave her, I guess it was my Facebook or my name, and said I was with the Ventress, but I had talked with her, and the Ventress took her on before. I guess it kind of blew up, and there was a lot more media coverage. Mm-hmm. And then Alcor actually took her on. She was able to raise a lot of funds on her own through the post. And then it was pretty easy to have other chronicists, long-term chronicists, after the Ventress took her on, because the Ventress vet people and look at their accounts and like what they have to contribute. And also try to find out, like, is there actually a diagnosis? Because sometimes, you know, someone might just say that they have something and they don't. I mean, just all of that, like trying to do a little investigation to vet them before they take them on. And then other, because the Ventress will raise, or they have for, you know, I'm a director with the Ventress. And before I became a director, like for Mars Johnson, who had been, that was the first, like, that they raised money for, who had been a, you know, president, very active in chronics a long time ago. And then I came on and helped with William O'Wright's, and he's preserved. And I'm also a director at, it's Longevity, which was called Immortality Institute. Mm-hmm. And he had been a lifetime member and had been active there before I had become more involved and been a director there. And then he had a successful campaign. And then after Kim, it was Aaron Winburn, who, that was the last campaign that the Ventress raised money for. So the Ventress started with Kim, and then Alcor also helped with that, and it was kind of transferred to Alcor. So, yeah, and then...
That seems really cool. Like, that's you know, kind of both kind of community building and you know, working to help these people, and really kind of you know, pursuing an interesting project at the same time.
Yeah, I remember talking to Kim, and before she had, I guess, contacted, just talking about chronics and what her family felt and all of those things. And that was when I was pregnant with my one that's three now. And so I was like I was sad about being pregnant, and she was so young and near the age of my eldest daughter.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, Kim's really just dealing with it in a very, as best as she could.
Yeah.
You know, she was doing everything she could to stay alive longer, you know, nutritionally, getting into experimental. I mean, as you know, there's coverage of what she did.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, on our, you know, in terms of our questions and stuff that you would typically encounter with people, you know, if somebody says, okay, but you're interfering with the natural process, or you're interfering with, you know, God's will for somebody, or, you know, something like that, how would you respond to that?
Well, the general thing is that I don't think anyone can truly say what God's will is, that it would be up to God to say if it would work or not. And then with natural order, there are many things we do that don't fit with natural order already. And I guess that's something that if we feel we can do more, you know, to help in the future, or if any of the ideas or from now would have any use, or the historical perspectives. yeah. But, and even that, it's not guaranteed at all that cryonics would work. And so some of it is just that you're supporting the research. What's used for organ transplant now came, you know, from research into better preservation chemicals for cryonics, you know, through 21st century medicine. So you're supporting some of those things in some areas of science that could help people who are living now. And again, it's also giving back to the community, and, you know, some ways that it's helping, that maybe just being in the ground wouldn't. But I'm not sure. There are different, I guess there are different ideas about what natural order would be, because if you're preserved with and in a casket, it's not quite natural either.
Right. Well, and we're living quote unnaturally long lifestyles, right. All this kind of stuff. I always find it interesting to think, you know, what people find you know, natural in the world around them, because from a historical perspective, it just doesn't add up.
I mean, there could be a case to be made that humans have a lot of fixing to do. If you look at it that way, if you need to heal the earth or help the species that are becoming extinct, or in some of those ways, that humans have a lot of work to do to get the world in a more natural order. I mean, I have talked to transhumanists that believe humans have to get off the earth. I mean, you know, yeah. you see everything in science fiction too. And then others think that, I mean, there are ways that the earth could just be, like, if, for instance, if we had green energy, flying cars, and, you know, we were able to give back more land, or if humans, to animals. I mean, there are, lots of different ideas about, but yeah, the idea about natural is interesting, because there are a lot of different levels to that, like what is natural. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know. It does seem interesting when we take these kind of frameworks we have about you know, what's natural or what's God's will, and then when we see something that we haven't seen before, we assume that it must be outside of that rather than inside of that. And to me, those assumptions are such a kind of indicator of something. I don't know what it is, but it seems it's much more than just actually caring about, you know, nature or God's will or something like that. It's this bias implicit that we already know what that includes.
Well, there's always someone who's going to be making a decision, right? Mm-hmm. About what, if there's a car that's driven, or what kind of car, or what kind of food is eaten, or where to live. I don't think, well, there are some people that try to live more in a biblical way, but that becomes very difficult in modern times. So Yeah.
There's a lot of AJ Jacobs, I think, tried that for a year. And then Rachel Held Evans, she spent a year trying to live as a biblical woman, with all the different patterns for biblical womanhood she came up with, and that was interesting as well. All of those experiments are really enlightening, because we even, you know, it's a lack of historical awareness for so many people. They think know what that means or what that, you know, would include, but then when you really look at it, you realize just how far away in time and space and so forth that kind of stuff is.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so you know, speaking
to the things that was in my book was kids and having religious education in the future, being able to kind of go into a more what would be like a simulated of the time, you know, being able to see it in a more real, like they're there, like some of the stories from the Bible and other religious traditions. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and that's what I was about to ask about, because you're involved in religious education and you're involved in the Unitarian Universalist Church, and that's as we Christian transhumanists see all the time, right? That's a little bit of a rarity inside a lot of transhumanist circles. So how did you get to that? What drew you into that world?
I went to listen to a long time ago a nutritional talk by, I believe it's about like macrobiotics and a man who was growing heirloom vegetables and kind of had overcome cancer. And it was hosted at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Eugene, Oregon. Hmm. And this is when my daughter, who's now 20, was probably still like a baby, you know, like 8 months old or something. And so that was kind of my first introduction to UUs. I didn't know what they were or what they did, but they saw that they had some interesting talks. So because I had picked up a flyer. And then later, when she was... Oh, she must have been about four and a half years old, because it was preschool. She had had a couple things happen where she had a little boy in her class that was talking to her about his version of like religion and God. And she also had a grandma who had a different religion and version that was talking to her. And so she was asking me questions, and I had seen that the UU church had a time travel for kids, like just one of their classes. Whoa. So they would have people dress up and be a different character from time to talk to the kids. And that sounded really awesome to me. Mm-hmm. So I started taking her to do the preschool class and to do the class. And when I moved from Oregon to Texas, Austin, Texas, mm-hmm. She was that time like 7 years old. I had started teaching, I guess, because they wanted volunteers, you know, at the church. And it was a lot of fun. So I really like doing the creative things. I also enjoy learning, like when you teach world religions and you're teaching what the other religions believe, or, you know, reading books that are written from kids' points of view, or at the social action, being able to do social action in the community. There are many aspects that I've loved, and even as my kids got older, you know, teaching our whole lives, like, you know, kind of a more comprehensive sex ed for that covers relationships and healthy relationships too. Mm-hmm. It was just a lot of fun. And sometimes I've also been able to throw in transhumanism in lessons. Like I was the divination teacher for an Hogwarts camp. And so I would bring in, I guess I had like a crystal ball, but I had laminated pictures of things like the paralyzed man who, you know, had the insert in his brain so he could move a cursor, just like all sorts of things, or robotic, hands. And
Nice.
It was a lot of fun because we could talk about things that scientists are working on or that we could have in the future and stuff like that. So, and kids just get excited about things like that. Like they like to tell their parents. And I've had some interesting conversations that way where kids leave my class and then the parents ask me about something that they learned. Yes.
That has to be an interesting conversation. The kids trying to describe what a brain implant is.
Well, yeah, that's a lot of fun. So,
I like how you're connecting like Harry Potter sort of story items with, you know, with these kinds of technologies and things like that. And also like I like that you were drawn into this by, you know, a time travel,
Oh, I was. Yeah. A long time ago. Yeah. That's very amusing.
Yeah. That's great. I love that kind of imaginative, edge to it in a way that I think is so often missing in most of, scientific and kind of edge technology discussions. So what do you see as, I know a little bit about the Unitarian Universalist, philosophy of education. Over time, there's been a lot of people who are like, oh, you can't, you shouldn't teach kids, about religion or whatever, because that'll corrupt their mind. And from what I understand, the UU take an approach of just teaching everything, teaching the whole world of religion.
Oh, they definitely do. Yeah. I think it was very useful for my own kids that are now 2018 and turning 16. I guess my eldest turns 21 this year.
Wow.
And what I saw with them is it gives an understanding of why people believe the things that they do, just learning, the pillars of Islam or, tenets of just everything, or, learning about Judaism or Hinduism or whatever, or Buddhism, or, whichever religion it is, or even the differences between Christians or, different Christian faiths. It's very useful, I think, to get a more worldview or even understanding. That's another thing that I've done. I've been as the religious educator on, committees for interfaith and gone to meetings with other faith, like where the kind of the leaders come together. Mm-hmm. They're in Austin, and then when I lived in West Texas and Lubbock, and then at that one we had a teen interfaith where we had, the teenagers go. And so they're meeting the kids from the other religions. And it's just very useful for them to figure out that they're teenagers like them, I guess, or have more understanding and not, like they got to go to the mosque and they got to, they did a, like a cooking class with, to learn, I guess that was the Turkish, the cooking class.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, just different things that are, useful for them. But I guess it comes back to like teaching them what some people criticize Unitarian Universalists. What do you teach them to believe? And it's kind of the whole, you're wanting them to figure out what to believe on their own, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like critical thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're trying to give them the all the kind of relevant tools and all the relevant information to be able to make those kinds of choices or understandings. So how do you, how do you think that compares, that kind of experience? You said it's useful. How do you think that compares to maybe, we might think of just kind of a middle American, secular family who basically doesn't have any kind of substantial religious information, certainly not about, the kind of world of religion?
Well, they definitely, I've encountered that. I have had friends from all different backgrounds. And I do have friends that have just been raised very American, very secular. And I think that they're less understanding of all religions, including Christians, and not like maybe you would think like a hostile atheist, but just being more dismissive of their views. And I think that you've got to understand people and why they have different views. I mean, I think that it's helpful to have that understanding.
Yeah.
Or dismissive, right. Not taking it seriously or really like understanding why these people that think differently than that is their life view. I don't know. It seems that maybe there's some empathy that's missing.
Mm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I've felt like it was, and just from my own kind of self-education or whatever, I've felt like understanding a little bit about other faiths and so forth has been really helpful in both understanding kind of what I'm encountering, but also understanding what is so unique about my own particular branch of that, right? Like my own particular religious tradition, it really is I'm able to understand it in a more comprehensive way, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. And within Unitarian Universalism, you have some people that are just inherently more spiritual or even into more of the Unitarian or the Universalist branch traditions, because they didn't come together, until much, much later.
Yeah.
So, that is, yeah.
Well, maybe speak to that for a second, because I don't think a lot of people are familiar with that. What are those two traditions, and what's the kind of distinction between them?
To me, they were so similar. That's pretty much how they came together. The backup. It's been very interesting for me the past 3 years, because we moved out to New England for my husband to teach at MIT. We moved from Texas, and it's been very interesting because there are so many more UU churches out here, and the ones that were Unitarian and the ones that were Universalists are all UU, but all these little towns around here in New England all had a UU church, 200 years ago, at the founding of America. Horace Mann, the church that we're members of in Newton, was a founding member of that church who started the, public education in America. So I guess I learned that they have a lot of history with America when I moved out here, even though I kind of read about it when I lived in Texas or long time ago. And so that's been interesting to me. But at the time, if you're looking at 200 years ago, you had the view that there was, I guess what today it's almost a agnostic, that the one God is, saving, is the same or saving everyone. And then you also have the other view that if there's a God, that they're a loving God, and they wouldn't turn someone away or send them to hell for not believing in them. Mm. So that's kind of the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you had that were more religious, or like, but you believe in a God, but the gods are the same, and then the other is like the universal, like God would take everyone or is a loving God.
Yeah, there, from what I've read, there, you know, those kind of two movements came from, you know, different kind of cultural places, and eventually kind of met up along the way. That's been interesting for me to read about. It's interesting that has had such a long term, even if kind of background, but effect on America in a lot of ways. That's intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah, like Clara Barton, and some of the people had very strong beliefs about, you know, the inherent worth and dignity and of all people and helping people. I mean, just in enacting social policy or, you know, change in America. So mm-hmm. That's one of the components that, you know, you teach the kids, like when you go through the religious education at the UU church. It's set up in kind of cycles where you'll spend a year doing world religions and you do a year doing Unitarian Universalist history. And you also take your year of social action. So you kind of go through these, cycles.
Yeah, that's cool. I love your life. It's so multifaceted. I love all the different aspects that you kind of bring to things. Before we go, is there any place where people should follow you or follow any work you're doing, or are there other resources that you think that people should look into or check out for themselves?
Well,
that was a huge question.
There's a lot of different things to parcel out. I'm most active currently just on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where, I mean, I'm not active. I have plans of things that I want to be working on when my child who's 3 is older. And that's but I'm also active at Longevity and with the Venturists. The Venturists do chronic support and advocacy. I guess the biggest thing is giving people do not autopsy cards or helping if people in their family are just very against cryonics, you know, being able to kind of talk to them or give ideas of how to approach. I mean, I've done that some, you know. I talk to people who have problems, you know, in their family to try to give them ideas. The Ventress, in kind of as a last resort, will also be in charge or help. And if there's a case where the family won't help at all, So I mean, help, if you need somebody to run your trust, things like that. Mm. And, if you don't just have life insurance set up to your organization, like to CI or to Alcor. And I guess that Longevity does, they fund some life extension research every year. We will support something that isn't getting kind of traditional funding or something that could be useful, like working with SINS Foundation. SINS Foundation is great to support if you're interested in helping with research and life extension. I do calorie restriction, but I've kind of do the, I guess it's called intermittent fasting. Kind of the eat once every 24 hours sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I generally do. But there are a lot of different, and I tried personally to exercise, and some of it is to keep up with my kids and, you know, try to be like a, you know, fun grandma. Like I have those views, like I want to be a fun grandma. I want to be in better, as good of health as, you know, long as I can. Yeah. So, yeah, but I'm, 41 now, so, I guess I'm not that old yet. No. But.
Yeah. It's great. And yeah, we didn't talk much about caloric restriction, but I'll put some links to that as well. And just give some information for people who are curious about those things. I'll put links to your few of your organizations there. And that'll be great. Thanks so much for talking to me and going through your whole life story.
I'm also a Lalechilik leader, and I've actually had transhumanists from around the world. Talk to them about if you ever need breastfeeding help. So
yeah,
definitely.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's great. All right. Well, Shannon, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you sometime soon. No doubt.
Okay. All right. Well, have a good day.
You too.
Thanks.
Bye.